welcome to another Alton Browncast. I have with me tonight, actually, recording from my trailer in a very kind of nondescript parking lot next to the L.A. River. Actually, I don't even know they call it the L.A. River in Burbank, where we're making a Cutthroat Kitchen. But I have got with me someone that I've admired for a long time, and I'm very, very glad to have on the show, Andrew Zimmern. Welcome.
Thank you.
I am going to strive to not ask you a single question that you've ever been asked before.
Okay.
Look,
you suffer from the same slings and arrows that I do, right? And there's a whole series of questions that everybody asks me.
What are the slings and arrows?
What's the worst thing you've ever eaten?
You know what? I don't care.
What's the most disgusting? When you're at home, does your wife like to eat the same food you do? And I get there are certain core values there that people are trying to dig at. But to me, after a certain amount of time, if somebody knows they're talking to me, there's so many more wonderful topics that I could talk to them
Look,
about.
All I'm going to say is, I mean, I've been an admirer of yours for a long time, not because you have made a career. No, I'm not going to say that. Not because you've spent a fair amount of your career mm-hmm. eating strange things. Mm-hmm. Okay, right. Fine. But what actually drew me to your work in the very beginning was not strangeness. It was not, mm-hmm. okay, the word bizarre.
Mm-hmm, sure.
It has always been the level of respect mm-hmm. that you seem to be able to bring to any subject that you're talking about, and I think that in the end your fans are drawn to that sense of respect. Mm-hmm. You never talk down. You never, you know what it is. You always manage to enlighten people as to the people.
Mm-hmm.
The food might be a conduit, and let me ask you this, okay. Are you actually still interested in food?
No.
Yeah, it's funny, I'm not either.
And that's one of the reasons, and I should reveal the full deck of cards for your audience. We're recording back-to-back
Please.
Podcasts.
We are. Oh, that's true. We're doing back-to-back podcasts. Andrew's being nice enough to do the Alton Browncast, and then I'm going to turn around and do his podcast.
That's right. So, Go Fork Yourself is going to be recorded here in your trailer.
Right
here. First
and
for
poor
us.
Andrew is sitting right next to the rack that holds my wardrobe where I do my ironing.
Oh, that's great.
Why aren't you interested in food anymore?
Because to me, I mean, look, I love food. I always have. I think we swim in it culturally. I think it's important. I think food, with a small f, when you and I started doing the stuff that we do print, in radio, on television, I think some of that has been hijacked by a lot of different people and a lot of different ideologues.
Taken by force. And used
misrepresented. Well, okay. It's been commercialized. I mean, just like anything else. Don't you remember, you know, 10, 15 years ago when things became all about the chef and then the TV thing exploded, and I knew, and you and I are the happy accidental recipients of a lot of success because of that. And so
yeah,
I try
you
not
planned
to
it.
Bite.
How much of that is accidental? You planned
well,
it.
Well, you plan it, but you can never count on it being successful. At some point, when you're doing the vehicles that you do, I do the vehicles that I do, an audience has to tune in and watch it, and you and I could sit here for the rest of an hour and start ticking off great ideas with great hosts on good networks that we thought were a slam dunk hint. They never went anywhere. But I'm also not interested, you know, so in a certain degree, I'm not as interested in food with a capital F as I was, but I'm also less interested in food when it comes to my show. I had a very purposeful secret plan with Bizarre Food. When I went and pitched it to Travel Channel the first time, Pat Young was the head of the network. And
what year was this? Do you remember
12 years
okay,
ago.
Okay, so well over a decade.
Oh,
ago,
yeah.
Because it's been going for a while.
Yeah. So we've been on the air 8.5 years, and, you know, we had 2 years running up to getting to that point, and I was trying to sell the idea before then. And I remember Pat listening to the idea and, telling stories about culture through food. Mm-hmm. Pretty simple, basic stuff, but unvarnished, docu-follow style, on and on. And I remember him saying to me, that's a great show. It'll be a really fun year on PBS to make 12 of them, and your colleagues will love it, but it's not commercial enough. He said, I'll make you a deal. I'll let you keep 25-30% of the intelligence in what it is that you want to do. If you'll give me a product with a sort of deeper hook. And I went back to the drawing board.
What was
board.
The deeper? Did he define deeper hook?
Well, the deeper hook ended up being, because I had explained to him that, you know, food's good. Food with a story is better. Food with a story people hadn't heard about is best of all. Those foods are found at the fringe. So rather than calling it Chew on This, which also, you know, my buddy Eric Schlosser would have had a problem with because his one of his kids' books was called Chew on This. But I wanted to call it Chew on This, and it was a show about ideas. And we ended up calling it Bizarre Foods, which was, you know, purportedly a show about food. And I fight every week in edit rooms and producer meetings to pull back. If the food was just the exclamation point at the end of the act, I'd be happiest, because I think that introducing the idea of the food as the reason that I'm there almost does a disservice to the what I call the story, which is the person who's doing the cooking and what their life is like, or the hunting or the trapping or the foraging or the culture or the tribe. That's why the immersive shows are my favorite, where I'm actually living with a people for 7, 8, 9 days, and we just, or 3 or 4 days, whatever it may be, and we just record it and present the story. We did that with 6 or 7 of the lost tribes of the world. We've done it with Tlingit in Alaska. We just did it our season premiere this year with members of the Atna Athabascans in Chistochina, Alaska. And your point about respect, I very intentionally, at the very first show, the pilot that we shot, I remember sitting there, and I was in a restaurant called the Asadachi. This is where men go for sport and eat, you know, lizard sake and raw frog, and, you know, the crazier the food, the better. And they try to duel each other, you know, getting drunk and eating crazy food. And they celebrate business deals and things like that.
Sure.
It's a very, very popular place. And it was scene one, day one of the pilot. And the first thing the guy did was had me select a frog out of a bag, and he ripped it out of its skin. And I remember him, you know, there's a course with the skin and the beating frog card and all this other crazy stuff. And he was a young Japanese chef, and he didn't speak English, and he was so dedicated to his craft, and he was working with such precision. And there were several producers on the trip, and one of them had talked to me before about, you know, here's your, when you're at that time, here's your chance to kind of be funny. And I thought to myself, I remember the camera, it was like slow motion, it turned around to me, and I had a decision to make in that very instant. I could make the Faustian deal, which would be to make fun of the young guy that didn't speak English. And it's really easy. You see a lot of those shows, right? I mean, it's, you know, it's someone who's setting up someone else to, you know, be the punchline. And I purposely just, I said, I can't do that. That's not me. And I didn't want to get trapped in a show that was successful where I'd have to act or be someone other than myself or pretend to be interested or make fun of someone. You know, I'd rather be a good guest in someone's home than tell them I don't like their food or make fun of them. I mean, that's just how I was brought up. So, yes.
You're brought up to where when somebody gives you food, you say thank you.
With a really big smile on your
plate. Yeah, because
you're
happy
to be
fed.
And you clean your plate.
Yeah.
You know, my grandmother, who lost siblings in the Holocaust, I mean, she would sleep at night with her purse under the bed and not out in the hallway in case the door got knocked down. And this was in the fancy pants West End apartment that my father and his brother bought her. You know what I mean? It's like we were always in that environment where everything could change at any moment, so you better be grateful. My crew, we've had some really funny moments with that in Madagascar, a lawless country with, you know, they just elected their first head of state in 14 years. At one point, a local disc jockey at the radio station in Antananarivo was the president of the country, but he didn't have any bag, didn't control anything. He was just president in name, I think, because he won some call-in contest on his own station.
he did a call-in show to elect a president, yeah. And he won.
And, you know, just a really harsh place to be living. And Jama, this fisherman, we went back to his house, and he apologized. We caught one big fish, and his wife, we ate the head and the tail because he could get money for the center
middle
of the fish.
Yeah.
And he apologized for that. And there were 8 of them sleeping in a one-room grass hut on the edge of the beach with no visible possessions. There's Sakalava people. Jama's wife was painted in yellow and white on her face, almost like a mask. And she was so desperate to offer us something because she felt bad about the fish situation. So she dug in the sand. I didn't know what she was doing. And she pulled out a little metal tin Looked like one of those saffron tins that you by saffron in 30 years ago, yellow and white on the outside. And she opened it up, and inside was a plastic baggie, and there was like a pale gray powder in it. And I realized it was instant coffee that had lost its color. And
now, how did you know that?
Because I just, something, she had the cups. I mean, you had to be in the scene. So, you know, there was boiling water, and the water... they had poured into a rice pod in Madagascar. They're the one of the things that they eat a lot of time is toasted rice water, because they let the rice burn into the pot, and then they use water. It cleans it out, but it also, they get every last bit of the rice, and it's
all the flavor,
nutrients, and it has that toasty flavor. So she poured the rice water into cups and stirred little bits of this old coffee in it, and all cracked cups. And I mean, it was one of the most humble, gracious, inspiring moments of my life. And she offered it at first to some of the members of the crew who were sitting there next to her, and one of my guys started to say, "Oh no, thank you," and I shot him that look that they're very
take it.
You take it, you drink every single drop of it, because I mean, this woman was partying with her only possession with us. And the more you see that kind of thing, the easier it really becomes part of your DNA to be as gracious and as kind and respectful as you can. The travel I've done on my show over the course of the 9.5 years we've been on the road, that's the best version of myself that I know of. I like the version of myself who's traveling much more than I like the person who lives in my house in Minneapolis with my wife and son. I have to struggle and think about being interested in other people and you know, being a little more selfless and, you know, sort of doing the right thing every day and being a good grown-up. When I'm on the road, it sort of comes naturally to me.
You're describing something that's a lot like I've heard descriptions of from soldiers during the Vietnam War who have a hard time coming home because they have a hard time adjusting to the what we have and what we don't have and what we're grateful for and what we're not grateful for. So you're describing kind of a wartime mentality almost, where things are stripped down to these elemental bits.
Yeah, I don't know if I could do these immersive shows or be in that situation every week. I know I have journalist friends who have the same sort of issue. I don't know if it's lucky for me or not lucky for me, but, you know, as often as I'm in that situation with Jama the fisherman in Madagascar, I'm also sitting in a, you know, a swanky restaurant in Boston, you know, about to get, you know, my seafood jam on. So,
and does that ever make you feel a little guilty?
Oh, all the time. I mean, it all makes me feel guilty. You know what makes me feel guiltier at all, guiltier most of all, is the overwhelming amount of love and attention that's thrown at the TV people in the world. It's why I'm so adamant about all of us doing good works with the platforms that we have. I think it's a really serious issue, and I applaud a lot of the people who do it. I have a hard time. Sometimes I come from a day with Jama the Fisherman, fly halfway around the world, come home, and I'm at, you know, a food event in Minneapolis where people are paying $500 a night to walk around with, you know, a wine glass that gets refilled and bid thousands of dollars on having someone come into their home and cook it. And we, you know, look, chefs and restaurateurs and the food people raise so much money that way for so many good causes. I'm not denigrating that at all. But sometimes there's a hijack. It's another way in which sort of the essence of what we're doing is hijacked, I think, by people. And it's a very slippery slope. And I think we're at a point in our lives right now where we have to really think hard about making sure that we devote as much attention as is possible. I'm not sure we're doing it currently.
You're saying we.
The food world. Folks, okay. Folks who are in a position to do a lot. And I include myself in that, because I always ask myself every day, am I doing enough? I told one of my business partners I wouldn't start any business that didn't have a charitable component to it. And I struggle with, you know, what I do with my TV life and making sure that that has that kind of component to it. I'm not setting myself up as a saint. Far from it. I'm the biggest sinner in the world, and I make more mistakes than anybody I know. I'm kind of schlumping along in life. But I will tell you that I think it's really, really important that those that have do a lot in 2014 that those that don't have. I mean, just look at the childhood hunger issues in America. I mean, it's criminal. So it's rough. It's hard to look at some of the excess in the world today. And at the same people who are, I'll give you a great example. we've all been at those dinners where we're in a restaurant and the chef just wants to crush everybody and puts lots of, you know, puts the thousands of dollars of food and, you know, the oysters and the sea urchins and, you know, monster steaks and things down on the table, right?
Yes.
And it's the same group of people that the night before or the next night were somewhere talking about childhood hunger and all the rest of that kind of stuff. And it's really hard to equate those two worlds. Much as it's hard, as you said, for that soldier coming home or for folks like you and I to find ourselves in some situations in our travels that are very humbling, and then to, you know, come home to the lives that we have. I'm so blessed. I mean, my son doesn't know what it's like not to have food in the fridge, you know? And I meet a lot of kids that don't have food in the fridge.
Most of the kids in the world don't have food in the
fridge. Correct.
Most of the kids don't have fridges.
That's right. That's exactly right. Well, I mean, Africans, you know, I'm in love with Africa and I'm in love with Africans. More Africans have cell phones than have electricity. You know, I mean, those kind of little factoids when they get dropped on you by someone, you know, in the know and some Jeep ride across, you know, some stretch of land over there is just fascinating. Your jaw just drops. You don't even know how to make sense of it.
I don't know how to make sense of that.
Yeah, no, neither do I. I, you know, but that's, you know, the great thing, and I'm a very, I mean, we've talked enough away from, you know, privately, you know, I think about these things a lot. I find it really interesting that as negative as sometimes I can get about things, and I can let myself go there in a big way, I am so bullish on what this new generation of young people are going to do to fix those sorts of problems. We have kids, you know, who are anywhere from 8 to 18 right now in this country who've grown up more socially aware of issues than at any time in the last, you know, since the 60s in America. And I'm really, really, really bullish on that generation. I think they have got their minds aligned. You know, my son thinks seatbelts are cool. He doesn't think cigarettes are cool. He's grown up watching food issues being talked about on television, you know? And I used to think, well, that's because we live in a, you know, in a lily white suburb of Minneapolis. And I gotten out, you know, we've done the last couple of years sort of exclusively in America. And I've had a chance to talk about this issue in schools with kids in Jackson, Mississippi. And they feel the same way. They've seen it. I mean, there's that Jamie Oliver moment in the first year of one of his shows where he holds up the tomato and says, "What is this?" I think he's in a school in West Virginia is where I think he was. And I know that was real, and I've been in those rooms. But the vast majority of them, they do know what a tomato is, because while some young people are being brought up in houses without refrigerators, there's more phones and TVs, and they're seeing images of this stuff, and there are people who are working so hard to preserve it. Just the conversations that we have these days, I'm constantly impressed by the work that some of the culinarians who have big platforms, you know, guys like Tom Colicchio and what they're doing with there, or Jamie Oliver, who, like him or not, has put his money and his career where his mouth is on, you know, for the last 15 years. I think that's really laudable.
How do you manage to balance it in your own life?
It's the biggest struggle that I have. I'm really good at the public me. I'm really good at showing at the office. I can lose myself at work. I'm a workaholic. Balance is a really hard thing for me. I mean, I'm 22 years sober, and that sort of has defined my life for, you know, the first, the vast majority of it. The last couple of years, what's defined my life for me when I'm really sharing about it is struggling to be a better husband and a better father, because I see more value in my family than I do in my career. And there are times where, if I'm really honest with you, you know, 10 years ago, I probably put more value in my career than I did in my family. And it's just the way it was for me. And I struggle with that a lot, especially because I have a successful show that requires me to be on the road a lot.
Yeah.
And that interferes, you know, and my, you know, my family's affected. We have a very unique dynamic, you know, within our family. And my attention is required more there than it ever was. But at the same time, I have commitments and things that I need to maintain to, you know, keep us all in orange juice and eggs. And I also have a commitment. I've created these products that I have people who've been with me for 12, 13 years, from bad times to good times, who I also support. They're a different kind of family of mine. It's not just some sort of anonymous thing called the network. I mean, there's people back in Minneapolis on my team that, you know, I'd bleed for. And it's hard. It's a struggle. I mean, it's all that grown-up stuff. I have a friend of mine who's got a great saying. He says, you know, some days there's just a little too much real life in life, and we all have days like that, right?
Some days, I'm not sure which one it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't always sort them out.
No, to be really honest. It is. It's tough. I know that I'll have a day, you know, I'm in town, I'm shooting a reality competition show that airs on a network, and, you know, when you're on them, you're not allowed to talk about them.
Of course not.
Of course not. But we all watch it. It's a great show. And, you know, so I'm on a lockdown set all day long, and, you know, we're eating and the chef testants are cooking and we're doing, you know, it's a lot of fun, and I'm hanging out with friends of mine and we're laughing and I take a break and, you know, I get the text from my wife, you know, about what's really going on back at home. And I'm just, you know, some days it's heartbreaking. Some days it's heartbreaking different ways. Some days it's like, oh God, I missed that. I really wanted to be there for that. And, you know, seeing your son, you know, do something in a school play, or, you know, the usual cliched stuff. And sometimes you just want to be a better husband to your wife because she's dealing with something all by herself that she didn't sign up for, being a single mom.
Right.
You know, so yeah, it's hard.
So, I mean, I guess that kind of begs the question, where do you want to go?
Well,
if you have these multiple blessings,
yeah,
we'll say, and but they don't always jibe,
correct,
with each other.
Yeah.
What
I'm so lucky. There are guys who are, you know, working two jobs and weekends and don't have the options of going to their boss and saying, I need to change my lifestyle. I need to spend more days at home.
Right.
You know, I'm extremely lucky in that, you know, we have a really successful product, and I have people who, you know, buy that product who are more interested in seeing me keep doing it than they are in killing the
they don't
fatted
want to kill the goose.
Calf.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, they're working with me so that I can spend less time on the road, still deliver the same show and do the stuff that I'm doing, but spend less time on the road. And that's the first time that we've really looked at that in my career in the last decade. So I'm really excited about that. Do you want to know what the lesson is?
Yeah, I do, actually.
Yeah, I'm lucky, but, you know, you go in and you speak the truth and you take a risk and you invest in the loss. And I was just honest with my boss, you know, and I just said, well, I need to, you know, I'm on a network called the Travel Channel, but I need to spend more time at home. And they're helping me do that. So I'm really grateful. I'm very lucky.
So in the end, all the travel leads home.
Of course it does. And you know something? My wife actually said to me, she said, you know, there is a balance to it. And she's much better at figuring out that balance than I am. Given my druthers, I'll pursue the love, money, and applause, right? And
Why do you think that is?
Oh, because I still suffer from me-ism. I mean, it's...
Yeah, but if you didn't have some me-ism, you wouldn't be able to do the work you do.
Some. The ideal word being some.
Yes, me-ism. Some.
I have a lot of healthy ego, you know, and I think that's benefited me. And I'm very competitive. And, you know, there's so many things I want to do in this business. I mean, I love telling stories on television. That part, I'm in love with. It's what I do. I'm good at it. And we're going to keep doing it. It's restoring that balance. We had one year, I think it was the third year we were shooting Bizarre Foods, that just primary, I think we did 35 episodes. I was gone for like 36 weeks just doing episodic travel. I mean, that's crazy, because then you throw in the non-episodic stuff that you have to do 3, 4, 5 weeks a year, and sure. I was gone 40 weeks. I mean, that's crazy. That's crazy. But I got, you know, you get caught up in all that stuff.
Was there ever a point... Seriously, was there ever a point when you were more at home on the road than you were at home?
Oh, of course. Of course, because when I'm at home, I have to deal with real life stuff. you know, that includes me and talking about my feelings and building relationships, which are hard, and being a parent, which is hard, as you know. I mean, oh my gosh, the work stuff was easy. I mean, you know, if you're good at your job, they say, then you never work a day in your life. Or if you're happy at work, you never work a day in your life. There are some days where it's like, you know, showing up at work was the easiest thing in the whole world. You can bury your head in it. You can escape in it. I mean, that's sort of one of the definitions of workaholism, which is why it's got holism at the end of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Do you still consider yourself to be a workaholic?
Absolutely.
but you're fighting it though.
Oh, correct. I'm in work recovery right now. It's, you know, there's
I like that. That's good. Recovery. I like that.
There's a, you know, for people that, you know, I've been sober for a long time, and
now,
they
let me stop what you're saying.
Yeah.
You made references now twice to being sober. What was life like before that?
Oh, I was a homeless street junkie and alcoholic 22 and a half years ago.
Do you mind if I ask you?
Not what at all. I talk about it all the time.
Well, I hate asking old questions.
Yeah, no.
But I am interested in how people make transitions.
Sure.
So you would say that was a low point. I assume.
Oh, for sure.
In your life, how did you turn that?
And now my greatest asset.
Well, sure, because liabilities tend to become assets if we play our cards right.
That's right.
How did you turn that?
Oh gosh, it was a. I was what we call in the trade a real alcoholic.
Okay, what's a real alcoholic then?
You think of it like an allergy. I put alcohol in my system and I break out in a horrible case of handcuffs or psych wards.
Have you been in handcuffs?
Oh yeah. Oh gosh, yeah. More than one occasion.
Been in psych wards.
Been in psych wards half dozen, seven times. Yeah. In New York City, if you're if you're found in some sort of psychotic state from drugs and alcohol, they put you in the psych ward. Drunk tanks are for people they find passed out on sidewalks,
sleep it
you
off.
Know, in bottle gangs and stuff like that. I've woken up in both places. Lost a ton of jobs, lost a ton of relationships, bottomed out several different times on several different chemicals. Finally, about a year and a half before I sobered up, I kicked hard drugs using Quaaludes, pot, and booze to wean myself off of heroin. And that worked. And then I started just drinking exclusively. And my life, that was the worst year of my life. Alcohol was so powerful. I mean, I had no idea how much I liked alcohol or how destructive it was until I quit everything else. And then my life got really bad. I lost my apartment in New York.
So you're saying that alcohol was actually worse than the drugs?
Oh, way worse. Worst thing in the whole world for me. This is just my personal story.
Is that because you had put everything into one substance?
Well, I think so. But also, alcohol is a real wild card in my system. And I only speak from my own experience. I spent many years very successfully in the restaurant business, walking around sniffing a mixture of heroin and cocaine all day long and just sort of maintaining an even keel. I could, you know, the restaurant industry in New York in the 80s was a good place to hide out if you had issues.
Still is.
Yeah, well, it can be. The professionalism in our industry has had a noticeable uptick. But yes, it still is. And I was such a mess that when you took away the other stuff and I just went for booze and that's all that I was, you know, you put enough booze in your system, I would wake up 3 days later. Something that never happened to me when I was just doing drugs, you know.
Well, technically speaking, alcohol is a greater toxin.
Correct.
Than a lot of drugs.
Yeah, and you know something what's very interesting is that, you know, alcohol has just been in our world for thousands of years.
It's accepted.
and it's accepted. If someone invented it today as a brand new substance, I think it would be classified as a class 5 narcotic. Like, I mean, you just couldn't get it. No one would be able to make it. I mean, it's really, really crazy stuff. And for me, it is like being allergic. I mean, there are some people who don't have the problem that I have, but when I put booze and drugs in my system, I don't know what's going to happen except that it's going to be really bad. And I can't control it or tell you when I'm going to stop. And so I went homeless. I was sleeping in an abandoned building down on Sullivan Street in Lower Manhattan. And
which is probably townhomes now.
Well, this is the great thing. You are so right. I took my wife back to New York about, we were still dating. So this is you know, 13, 14 years ago. And I took her back and I turned the corner. I walked down a couple blocks and I did that thing without looking first where I swept my arms open. And I said, this is the horrible place that I came from. And I think it was an Agnes B on the first floor and
a Starbucks.
$1 million homes. Yeah. And Sandra Bullock's townhouse is like two doors down. And it was pretty, it didn't quite have the gritty, visceral effect on her that I thought it would. But one day I woke up and the ace bandage of terror that had been around my chest for a long, long time that I treated it medicinally with drugs and alcohol, my fear, it just wasn't there. And I picked up the phone, I called a friend and I asked for help, which I had never done before. And, you know, 3 days later, I was in Hazelden.
Friends?
Well, I had, that's a very good point. I didn't. But I had someone, you know, one person in my life that responded right away. A whole bunch came to my intervention 2 nights later. Some didn't. My parents didn't. They at one point thought I was dead. And so they just, you know, my dad didn't talk to me, and rightfully so, for a couple years after I was sober, because he just couldn't deal with the heartache of seeing me relapse again. And I'd just been chronically apologetic to him, always crawling back, always convincing him I was done for good, and then gaining his trust. And then, you know, he would just be shattered and disappointed, which I understand as a parent now. And, you know, so, you know, I sobered up and I stayed sober. And it's why I live in Minnesota. It's how I got from New York to Minnesota. And
easier to be sober in Minnesota than it is New York.
Well, you know, I started out at, I went to Hazelden and they suggested I live in one of their halfway houses. And so at 6 months after I had completed, you know, what, you know, the Hazelden continuum of care had suggested, I said, okay, I'm going to go back to New York. And a really good friend of mine happened to be visiting out there from New York who had gone through Hazelden before me. And he looked, we were having a cup of coffee, and he said, why are you doing this the hard way? And I looked at him like he was crazy. And he said, whenever you've been home, you were never able to stay sober. You tried a million times. Out here, you've never sounded better, looked better, seemed healthier. You actually seem a little happy. And I said, I am. And he said, why throw that away? He challenged me. He said, you know, when it stops working here, come home. And it's 22 years later and I'm still living there.
Most people don't have this story. Most people don't have that turn.
No. And it was, you know something, it's and I'm not trying to make too much of it, but I remember from my college education taking a you know, it's the Joseph Campbell, the hero's journey sort of thing. If you don't have somewhere in your life where you crash and burn, it's hard to learn certain lessons. I mean, when things are going good, I'm not a really good student. When things are bad, I learn a lot. And that's what I always tell my friends when we're talking about stuff. If things are going bad, pay attention, because that's when we get to soak it all in. And I was really lucky. I went back. I started washing dishes in Minnesota and picked up my restaurant career again. And, you know, actually in a restaurant, one day I showed up as the dishwasher and the next day I was the head chef. The owner had some problems with his chef, and I told the guys that I can do that guy's job. And I had been looking for a raise. I actually wanted to be a busboy.
Wanted to get up to that $6 an hour.
Correct. Yeah. Well, I wanted to be tipped, and I knew that I was a tipped employee, I had the gift to gab and I could get back out there. But as the dishwasher, you're standing there in the pan area and you're watching the guys on the line. And I did that for 4 or 5 months while I was in the halfway house.
And you had done all these jobs.
I knew all their stations. Yeah. I mean, I had been working in restaurants in New York for Ann Rosenzweig and Thomas Keller. And
did the other people on the line
chefs.
Know this, by the way?
No. I'm in Minnesota. I'm the kid from the halfway house. And so the owner of the restaurant, you know, threw me out of his office and said to me, you're the dishwasher. You're not even a cook.
You don't get to peel potatoes.
Right. So the next day, the sous chef had taken over. The next day I showed up to work and the grill guy wasn't there. And I said, look, I can do the grill station, you know, and he's like, oh, okay. And the grill station for lunch was, you know, the chicken pie art, a grilled trout. The salamander was over the grill. So you took care of the onion soup and escargot. It was a French bistro.
And
steak frites and, you know, it was simple. And I, you know, the night before, the guys had plossed out pretty well for the next day. And so I sharpened up stuff in the station. And, you know, we did 150, 160 covers at lunch in a 120-seat restaurant. And after lunch service was done, the owner of the restaurant called me into his office. And he said the sort of hinted at the question that you asked before. He said, "Who are you?" And I
sure,
said,
because here you came from the dish.
Right, and the dishwasher.
The
and he said, clearly,
to the line.
Clearly you cooked before. And I said, yeah, well, I cooked in New York, blah, 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 blah. And I told him, he said, what are you doing from New York? I said, halfway house. And so then I started line cooking. Within a couple days, I took over the kitchen and hired a bunch. It was actually a really great story because I hired a bunch of line cooks from New York and Los Angeles who had also gotten out of treatment at the treatment centers in Minnesota, St. Mary's, Hazelden, all these different places. Chefs in restaurants would send their, you know, their talented guys that needed to take a break from booze and drugs, and I hired them all. And we had an all-star team of people there, and we quickly became the best restaurant in town for about 3-4 years. It was a great time because we would have impromptu 12-step meetings in the back of the restaurant after lunch hour, and then we'd all go back and crank out dinner service and go home. And there wasn't a lot of drinking and drugging in our kitchen for obvious reasons.
Obviously.
And it was a really sweet time in my life. And things kept getting better in Minnesota. So why would I leave? Started doing local TV, local drive time radio, writing for a local magazine, and then kaboom, the next thing I know, we did the pilot for Bizarre Foods, and now I'm sitting here in your trailer.
In Burbank,
California. it's goofy how, I mean, life, I mean, holy cow, it's unbelievable.
It's goofy stuff.
It is goofy, goofy stuff. But it is I really have gotten to the spiritual introspection that kind of life story gives you is, it's a powerful tool and a great gift. So I, you know, that's why I think I'm so hung up on this concept of all of us doing our part and giving back, because I see so much of my selfish self in the idea of not doing it. It's really easy to choose not to, you know, every day go home with your toys and keep stacking them up and all the rest of that and not sharing any. And I just think the world, I've seen the world, and it needs us all to be sharing. You know,
and the more world you see, the more you believe that.
Oh, without a doubt. And especially touring around this country. I mean, we did 5-6 years exclusively international, and we've done the last 3 years exclusively in America. We have a couple of international shows that I snuck in there as a little bonbon for the fans at the end of this year. And then next season, when we start shooting in June, we're going back to international again. But we're in Lima and we're in Cartagena. And the more that I saw of this country, the more firmly convinced I was. Because when I'm in a slum in Delhi, India, I expect to see that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why it is. Maybe it's some kind of like, you know, inbred ethnocentricity that it's like, oh, it's not in my own backyard. This is horrible, but it's not in my own backyard. And when you see the same thing in America, sometimes worse, it feels just awful that this is part of the country that I live in, where I vote, where I pay taxes, and we can't feed all of our children. We can't, you know, put books in school and take care of our, you know, senior citizens with some sort of grace and honor and respect. And, you know, I mean, it's not right. It's not right.
How do you think we got there? How do you think we've become the country that can't do that?
Do you know something? At the end of the day, speed kills, right? I mean, you remember that slogan when from the 70s? And I really think everything got sped up and so convenience-oriented, so fast. You know, I listen to a lot of these TED Talks. They're fascinating. And one of the big themes that a lot of people are always touching on, really smart people, smarter than me, is, you know, how much we've grown as a culture and advanced in the last 40 years versus the previous 4,000, right? The last 10 years versus the previous 1,000. I mean, all these wonderful sort of nifty slogans and stories about that. And I think sometimes you speed up so fast, it whirs by you, you're not paying attention. And I mean, look at the situation with what I know best, which is the food world. We mechanized and sped up our food system so much that we're, you know, poisoning our children and, you know, damaging our ecosystems and creating an unsustainable situation. And it turns out that everyone is basically in agreement. While they'll argue about the goals and they'll argue about the actual vehicle for change, everybody agrees that the solution lies somehow in stepping back 20, 30 years. You know, we still need to use science to help feed all these people. We still need to use the mechanization and some of the things that are very positive in our modern life to help move food around and take care of folks. And who would you know, who would argue that our advances in medicine, you know, aren't, you know, useful, but that there's an attitude about food that we sort of need to take a step back in to solve some of our bigger issues. And I think that's very true. So that tells me that a lot of our societal issues are speed related.
What do you think about, and it's a tough question and one that I wrestle with from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
What's the role of food media in all this?
Ooh.
I mean, we don't have to go there. I mean,
no, it's fascinating. I mean, this is what we all, those of us who have a foot in each, you know, camp, and this is what we talk about endlessly. I think food media is great because I think media is great. And I think there are people who report and who do great jobs of storytelling and educating people, because I think educating people is the most valuable thing that we can do with, you know, our TVs and, you know, websites and radio shows and podcasts and stuff like that. I mean, there's a lot of people who are tuning in right now who are fascinated that you and I are talking about this stuff. There's a whole bunch of people that want the Alton Brown that they see on TV and the Andrew Zimmern they see on TV to be making jokes about, you know, they'd love to hear you make jokes about how many testicles I put in my mouth. And they think that there are some fans of ours who are probably disappointed in the tone of the conversation. And I think that the fact that you and I are talking about these things is really cool. And there's a lot of other people who are talking about those things. It's really cool. And you rap, I mean, my, you know, Noah loves watching you on TV because you rap an awful lot of really fun, smart stuff in some cool entertainment. So I think there's that side of the media that I think is really, really positive. I think that the analysis of what we do in our lives, whether it's a political reporter or a food reporter or dining columnist or whatever, I think is really, really valuable. The corner of the quote unquote food media that I think is troublesome to me are the shows on television that don't really have a point, you know, or don't have a lesson to be learned. You know, I'm thrilled that you're the new web series that you're doing is back, because that's something that people love from the Good Eats days, right? And it's, you know, we'll talk about more of that on my podcast coming up.
Which we'll do next.
We'll do next. The fascinating thing to me is that there are people who get out there and do shows where there's no other point but entertainment. And I believe in entertainment for entertainment's sake, but I have more of a problem with it every day across all different cultural streams. Doesn't matter what we're talking about, food or, you know, movies, or if you don't have a point, or if there's not some part to it that is meaningful and can change someone's life, in my old age, I'm just not into it. There's a lot of food media out there in terms of reportage that I think overly fetishizes what we do. I don't like being at food festivals and have someone from some weird cable access station that's all about lifestyle and, you know, gets in my face with a microphone and wants to, you know which party I'm going to. The first question is, what party are you going to later? And I'm just like, you know, oh my gosh, no, I'm just not. That just is pointless kind of stuff to me.
So you have never really, how do I put this? Become part of the scene. You've never become part of the food scene.
I'm on the fringe of it because there's a lot of people in the food. I mean, look, as a member of the, I've always felt that you can affect a lot of change on the inside. People have publicly asked me, why do I have relationships with car companies like Toyota? There's no commercial endorsement here. Or why do you work with companies like General Mills? And it's really simple.
Which you do your award show with. I do the Munchies with.
And, you know, they're in my backyard. I do a lot of other stuff with General Mills.
They are local.
People call them out and say, you know, well, they're the ones that are putting sugar in kids' cereal. It's like, yeah, but when you're they do. But there's not a person in that company that isn't working to create the next version of, rather than creating healthy versions of Lucky Charms, they're trying to invent the next cereal, the next thing that supplants that. And the world wants healthier food and needs it. And they have, you know, 10,000 people sprinkled around the world working hard to develop things across all platforms like that. And I'm actually on the inside with people there asking me, what should we be thinking about? What should we be doing? I'm not giving up that seat. General Mills isn't going anywhere. They're doing just fine. And they're not going to suffer the same problem that Kodak did. They're going to be around. The Cargills of the world are going to be around. And yes, even the Coca-Colas of the world are going to be around. And I'm 52. I remember in the 80s being in rooms with lots of farmers and activists and stuff and screaming and shouting about solutions, and the enemy were those big food corporations. And I no longer think that they're the enemy. I think those are some of the companies that can help provide solutions and do it really fast because they're set up for it, and they're not going away. And I think there's the essence of civics, which is something I'm more interested in than divisiveness, which is represented by politics. I'd rather be working with those people on civic solutions than I would screaming and yelling about, you know, the fact that, you know, they have some practices that we're, you know, we disagree with.
Well, politics almost much never same, generates an answer.
No,
it very rarely not today. Does anything ever come out of
not today.
Politics.
And the it's I apply the same thing to the food scene. I do not travel around in packs with an entourage and security people, and I don't do the thing. But do I go to a handful of festivals every year? You bet I do, because I'm the one that gets to stand up. I always do my kids' demo at South Beach. It's the best day of my life. Yes, I do that Sunday night party, and this year we did it with the Munchies, and there's 5,000 people there in music. But when I get up and thank people, I get to talk about the issues that I believe in for 35 seconds or a minute in front of 5,000 people that listen really intently to what I have to say. This year I got to cook crickets for the kids out at the island, and it was in the place I thought I was at a rock concert. The kids went bonkers. The adults went bonkers, and they tasted it. When you see a little 8-year-old girl turn around to the audience, you know, 2,000 people in the arena, and they're like, I like it. And I had the same, you know, Filipino kids are, you know, eating them in, you know, in Cebu, like they're going out of style. It's really, really cool. Because at the end of the day, the core values of my show are about having less conversation about what divides us, skin color, political system, sexuality, religious beliefs, and more conversation about the things we want to talk about and love, which is our enjoyment of spending time with each other over food. And that is about not practicing contempt prior to investigation. It's about acceptance and tolerance and understanding of other people and other cultures. And at the end of the day, that's what I'm all about. And if I stay true to that ideal, whether I'm in, you know, on the campus at General Mills, whether I'm on the campus at a college giving a talk, or whether I'm on the beach with a fisherman like Jama in Madagascar, I'm okay. As long as I keep that idea in front of myself, I'm okay.
Andrew, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks, pal.